welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Koenigsein. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Koenigsein with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to be continuing to look back at some of our previous conversations, and we're going to be revisiting the conversation with Kim Cameron. Kim is a professor at the University of Michigan, Ross School of Business. He is seen as an expert in the area of leadership and specifically positive leadership. He's written a book by that title. And we're going to be taking a look at that conversation today. I encourage you, if you're a new listener, go back and listen to some of the previous episodes and please subscribe. Looking forward to today's conversation with Kim Cameron. To have Kim Cameron joining us from Michigan this morning. And Kim, I guess first off, can you just give us a little bit of your background and your story?
Sure. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for the chance to be on your show, and thanks for the chance to talk to you. It's a delight to meet you. I started out learning about or beginning to learn about organizations in an undergraduate program at Brigham Young University in sociology, but I learned that there are way too many ization words in sociology: centralization, specialization, formalization, and so on. Never did make much sense to me. So I ended up getting a PhD in a multidisciplinary program at Yale. We had psychologists, sociologists, economists, political scientists, and this potpourri of faculty members, 20 students, 13 faculty. So my largest course was 5 students. It was a wonderful experience, way, way too expensive now for any program to run like that. But I ended up... my first job was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Then I ran a research center in Boulder, Colorado, studying how to manage colleges and universities. During that period of time, the major challenge faced by higher education was that the baby boomer cohort had been through the higher education system. Their children had been through the higher education system, and there was a dramatic drop-off in simply the number of college-age students available to go to school. The prediction was, that was 400,000 fewer students. The prediction was, if you spread that across 3,500 colleges and universities in the United States, about a third of colleges are going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. So decline, retrenchment, became a big issue. So we started studying, well, how do organizations manage retrenchment? The reason that's important is every theory, every model of organization performance assumes that bigger is better. We get more next year than we got this year, we're doing better. Our scores go up, we're doing better. Nobody had studied, well, what happens when you have to manage going south? Well, I finished that 3 years running that research center, and then came to the University of Michigan, wanted to continue that, so I went to start studying businesses. And the word that was current at the time was downsizing, retrenchment, consolidation. There were lots of words, but downsizing was the key. Over a 10-year period of time, what we discovered is that almost all organizations that downsize deteriorate in performance. That is, profitability goes down, morale goes down, engagement goes down, communication goes down, and customer satisfaction goes down, and so on. However, that led, what I observed is 10 or 15% of organizations flourished after experiencing downsizing. So the question became, what's the difference between that small number that gets a lot better and everybody else that doesn't? I didn't have data, but the assumption that I was beginning to make as a result of observing and studying these schools is that the organizations that got better were characterized by virtuous practices: compassion, forgiveness, integrity, generosity, and so on. Now, the trouble is, certainly back then, that was not a legitimate way to describe any organization. The word virtuous, too philosophical, too religious. I mean, so I decided I was going to shift my focus and study the extent to which you could measure or identify what it means to be a virtuous organization. I mean, how would you know that that was the case? What would you look at? How would you measure it? And then if you could measure it, how would you improve it or change it or help an organization try to implement it? Well, I had just, long story short, I got together with two colleagues here at the University of Michigan, Jane Dutton, who had organized a compassion lab. That is, she began, well, there's a long story about how she got interested in compassion, but she began the same assumptions that I had, and that is that compassion can be an organization phenomenon as well as an individual phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then my friend Bob Quinn, with whom we've had a close association since we were 21 years old, been studying deep change and so on, we got together and created a center. The motivation for the center was we knew that it's the default option normally of professors is to go do their own work, sit in the library, sit in your office and get your work done. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to learn from each other. So a center was the glue that put us together. And the center is called the Center for Positive Organizations. And that center is now focused on multiple aspects of what it means to be a positive organization. Virtuousness, for sure. Positive deviance, extraordinarily spectacular, positive performance. And then sort of an affirmative bias, regardless of the challenge, the difficulty, the problems. Is there a way to focus on the positive aspects of that? And if you do that, what happens to organizations and to employees? So my own work now for the last maybe almost 20 years has been focused on how do you measure virtuousness, and especially how do you help organizations become more virtuous, and how does that translate into leadership? So we talk about the phrase positive leadership as being simply defined as focusing on a set of practices, all of which lead organizations to flourish, to thrive, to be better, to be positively deviant. Now, that's a long mark, a long explanation of how I got to where I am.
It sounds like an interesting journey. And I know when I had a conversation a while back with Bob Quinn, he spoke highly of your partnership and your work together, and it's fun to hear about your journey. I ask this question of every person that comes on, or most every guest that we have on, and I'm curious of your answer. But if knowing what you know now, if you were to think back when you were in your early 20s, 22-year-old Kim, what advice would you give him, knowing what you know now?
I have gotten some good advice along the way. One of the pieces of advice that I got was from a senior guru professor that I didn't have in class. He actually joined the university after I left, after I graduated. But I went back during a summer because I knew that he was there, and I asked him to take me on as an independent study student as I was preparing to try to figure out where I wanted to get my PhD. He handed me a couple of articles that he'd written. They were classic articles. I knew them. He was the person that sort of defined a certain area of sociology, actually, at the time. He said to me, here, I want you to read these papers, and I want you to give me advice about how I can improve these papers. I said to him, look, I know these papers. I know that they're the benchmark. I mean, I can't improve this work. These are classics. He said, well, you and I need to have a conversation then. He sat me down and he said, look, when you go get your PhD, if I treat you as a subordinate, you're always going to be a subordinate. It's not going to change. I don't want a subordinate. I want a colleague. So look, I know some things you don't, but you know some things I don't. I mean, we have different experiences. I want you to teach me as much as I teach you so that we have a collaborative relationship, so that we grow together. That was a brand new idea for me. I mean, I was a student, he was a professor, and I thought, well, I'm subordinate. You feed me and I'll eat. I learned that contribution was a key element in almost every relationship and every learning activity. So since then, I've done a whole bunch of research, as it turns out, on contribution as a predictor of performance. That is, making contributions is actually a higher a factor that's more important in predicting positive outcomes for me and for others than is achievement or goal accomplishment. So there are two kinds of goals. I need to make that more clear. Two kinds of goals. This study was done at the University of Michigan, in which a group of freshmen were all identified as they entered Michigan. They were asked to identify their goals for the year. Now, everybody has lots of goals, but they were categorized into two types. Achievement goals. I want to get good grades. I want to be popular. I want a girlfriend. I want to get elected to a club office or something. The other kind of goal was called contribution goals. I want to make a difference. I want to have something to get better because I would have contributed. So people were put into two groups depending on which type of goal was dominant. Then the study was to simply follow these students for 1 year, measuring things like, for example, how well they got along with the roommates, social factors, you know, how many times they got elected to a club office and so on, what their grade point average was, what their test scores were at the end of each semester, cognitive, academic factors, how many minor physiological symptoms they experienced, got the flu, headache, nausea, cramps, and so on. They missed class. So physical factors. On every single dimension, those with contribution goals did better on every statistically significant difference on every dimension, cognitive, social, physiological, than those who had achievement goals. That is, contribution was a better predictor of performance than achievement. Well, I learned that early, and that would probably be my advice, is that be a contributor, make a difference. Don't worry about popularity. Don't worry about fame. Don't worry about making sure everybody knows your work. Forget that. Just make a contribution.
Great. Yeah, great advice. As we're living during some unusual times, and we were talking a little bit before we started our podcast this morning, that things look differently than they did last fall for you and for everybody else that that's listening. During this time, and you know, I was telling you that, you know, the leaders that I'm talking to, a lot of them sound kind of exhausted over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months that we've been going through this pandemic. What is some advice that you give a leader that to stay positive? You've spent the last 20 years of looking at positive leadership and the difference it can make in organizations, but What are some things that you could give somebody some advice just to maybe help them during this time?
It's a good question, and I wish there was a cookbook, Mark. If there were, we'd all be doing different things if we had that the ideal. But I'll tell you a little bit about what I've studied and what I've become convinced of. You and I mentioned just barely before we started. One of the key findings that has emerged out of my own work is something referred to as the heliotropic effect. Now, I need to define what that is. As it turns out, every living system, everything alive, has a tendency toward the light and away from dark, or toward positive energy, away from negative energy. See, in nature, the sun is a source of positive energy. It's the life-giving force. So every living system, literally from single-cell organisms to complex human systems, everything alive has a tendency to that which is life-giving, positive energy, and away from that which is life-depleting. That is, negative energy sucks the life out of people. Negative energy does that. Well, if that's true, and it is, there's lots of evidence that that's true, and I won't go into all that. But if that's true, that is, if positive energy is a life-giving force and negative energy is life-depleting, then in this environment in which we live, where there's lots of challenges, obstacles, uncertainty, chaos, life-depleting forces, then what we're advised to do, what we should be doing, is to try to counteract those with life-giving, life-enhancing, life-facilitating forces or positive energy. Now, what would be positive energy? Well, there are lots of kinds of positive energy. One kind is called physical energy, which when I use it, it diminishes. I mean, if I run a marathon, I can't do it again. I got to have recuperation time. So using physical energy diminishes over time. Mental energy is the same. When I use it, I get exhausted. I need recovery time. That's why we have semester breaks and so on. Right. Emotional energy is the same. I get in an intense interaction. I'm debating somebody. I get exhausted. Mental energy diminishes with time. The only kind of energy that elevates with use is called relational energy. Well, what's relational energy? Well, when I interact with Mark, what happens to my energy? Is he uplifting, elevating, life-giving, or is he exhausting, depleting, just sucks the life right out of me? In which case, he's a de-energizer. Well, as it turns out, there are lots of factors that foster, create positive relational energy. And we can measure that pretty easily in organizations. The research is very clear that positively energizing leaders get substantially higher results in their organization than normal leaders. So, for example, one of the ways to measure relational energy is to simply have people rate the relationship they have with other people. So when I interact with Mark, what happens to my energy? Am I uplifted, elevated? Is he life-giving or exhausting, depleting? In which case is a de-energizer. I can measure that just on a Likert scale. I give him a 1, I would give this relationship a 1 if it's very de-energizing, a 7 if it's very energizing. So in a team, on a senior level team, or we've done that with entire organizations with thousands of people, you can measure the relational energy among various people. You're not rating the person, you're rating a relationship. Okay. Another way, by the way, that's one way to measure who's the leader. Another way is on the basis of influence. I mean, 95% of the leadership literature equates leadership and influence. If you're influential, you can get people to do what you want them to do. That means you're a leader. That's normally the assumption. Sometimes there's another third, that's sometimes information, the smartest person, the person who's most informed, the person who has access to all the information, all the organization secrets, that's the leader. So you can measure, or you can create influence networks, information networks, or energy networks. Turns out, here's the results of the research, and here's the whole point. Your position in the energy network is 4 times more important in predicting performance than your position in the influence network or the information network. That is, energy trumps influence by a factor of 4. And the question is, well, does anybody ever manage energy? I mean, does anybody ever get hired or promoted or, you know, rewarded in any way for being a positive energizer? Normally not. We don't even know it exists. But it trumps what we normally manage by a factor of 4. That's one factor. Second, if Mark is a positive energizer and I can just get around him, my performance goes up. That is, positive energizers affect the performance of other people around them. There's lots and lots of examples of that. And then the third major finding is the highest performing organizations have at least 3 times more positive energizers than normal organizations. The whole point is everybody can be one. Everybody can be a positive energizer. Everybody can't be influential. I mean, if you're influential and I'm influential and we disagree, most likely we're going to fight or there's going to be conflict. On the other hand, if you're a positive energizer and I'm a positive energizer, rather than conflicting, I mean, there's no reason to fight about who's the most positively energizing. In fact, because it's heliotropic, I'm attracted to positive energy, you and I most likely are going to collaborate. So you can see why organizations that have a lot of positive energizing going on are much more collaborative, much higher performers. They simply do better. So that's one of the pieces of advice. Find the positive energy in the system. Find the positive energizers in the system and just capitalize on that. Find ways to put yourself in a position where there's positive relational energy. Sometimes that's family. Sometimes it's putting a team together. Sometimes it's simply having interactions. When we're isolated, it's tougher, but it's possible. You and I are having at least some kind of relational energy going on right now.
So during this time that a lot of people are working virtually, and the energy that comes through the screen is different than being there in person. Anything that would help a leader to be able to keep his team, the energy level up? Any thoughts around that of what's worked?
Thank you. So I'm going to rely on some of this research we're doing regarding practicing some virtuous activities. For example, the idea of gratitude. You've heard that before. It's become relatively popular. It all emerged as a result of a study by a friend of mine, Bob Emmons, who in his class had all the students keep a journal. Everybody was required every single day to write in his or her journal. However, half the class was required to keep a gratitude journal. Write down three things every day for which you're grateful, or write down the three best things that happened to you today. The other half just wrote down three events, three people he interacted with, three problems they faced. At the end of the semester, several studies were done. One is all the students were given a flu shot. 7 days later, those students they were tested for the number of antibodies in their system. Those keeping a gratitude journal were significantly healthier, had more antibodies in their system than those not keeping a gratitude journal. They did a study of, there's been more than just the students, but in addition to that, there was a study done with heart health patients, people who had heart difficulties. Half of these people were assigned to keep a gratitude journal for 8 weeks. Half didn't. At the end of 8 weeks, they tested heart health. Those keeping a gratitude journal had deteriorated less, and actually their hearts had healed more than those not keeping a journal. And so on. There are a whole bunch of those practices. So one of the things we do in our organization, including virtual meetings on Zoom, is that we start every meeting going around the group, asking everybody to take 30 seconds or so to simply say, what's the best thing that's happened to you this last week or this last month? Or what should we celebrate? We just inject a bit of positive energy. That's one thing. A second thing I would suggest is back to that notion of contribution. The idea that contribution trumps achievement, has been verified. So what would that mean? Well, one of the ways to think about contribution instead of just rewarding people for doing well, one of the people in our business school knows about this. She's in charge of all the faculty support personnel, the secretaries, essentially. She's instituted a 1+1 award system. So if you do especially well, I give you an award, but then I give you a second one, which you can hand to somebody else. I don't know about them, but you do. So every time somebody excels, they get a chance to give an award. Delta Airlines does something similar to that. I mean, I've reached past the 3 million mile mark on Delta. But what does Delta give me for being a loyal flyer? They give me certificates, which I can then hand to a Delta employee, a flight attendant, a gate agent, somebody. When they do something extraordinary or special, I hand them a certificate. Now, I'm not sure what that does. It's points in their bank. It's free flights or something. But when I do that, I mean, they get teary. I've had people want to give me hugs, you know, as a result of having me hand them a certificate. It is a big deal to them. I mean, I think Delta gets it right. My reward for being a good customer is I get a chance to give something to somebody else. That is so terrific for me. And so on. I mean, there are a whole bunch of find ways to contribute. Now, many times an organization that's will volunteer, will go help City Year or Habitat or something. Sometimes, however, it's just in our meetings. This week, Mark, you're assigned to teach us all something that you've learned that's new and interesting. Next week, my turn. And by the time we get around the group, about every 2 months, you've got to have learned something new that you're going to teach us. I mean, everybody is a contributor and takes that seriously. We're going to help the entire group get better. So that's just, I mean, those are small, incremental, easily implemented factors, the research of which shows that positive energy performance goes up. The number one objection to all this positivity business is that, wait a minute, Cameron, I mean, I got stock price I got to worry about. I got performance measures. I got profitability goals. I got sales targets. I got customer satisfaction I got to manage. I mean, look, I don't have time for this soft, soupy, syrupy stuff. You could show me how it affects what I'm held accountable for. I might pay attention, but otherwise, it's irrelevant. It's nice to do, but I don't have time. So my entire career the last 20 years has been asking the question, actually, does it pay off in organization performance? Is there any evidence that if you pay attention, what you're held accountable for actually goes up? Turns out there's a lot of evidence that organization performance, profitability, productivity, those kinds of things, customer satisfaction, quality, innovation, all go up substantially. So we have a number of studies that show that's the case. I mean, big differences, statistically speaking. But there are two or three other anecdotal examples. Let me give you just one story about an organization. We got to know pretty well and were involved in helping them. Prudential Financial is the organization, big multinational financial services organization. Their retirement business was in trouble, floundering. And they knew that if you're floundering in retirement business and finance, you're in trouble because that's where people put their money. Mm-hmm. They decided in order to be competitive in the marketplace, they had to merge with another financial services retirement business. They picked Cigna. They said it was like merging the Yankees and the Red Sox. One in New York, one in Boston. They didn't get along at all.
Sure.
Contrasting cultures and so on. But they did it. The CEO of Cigna became the CEO of the merged company, Prudential Retirement. His name is John Kim. John essentially, I'm going to make a very long story, about a four-year story shorter. John Kim became the CEO, and he called us out and said, come help me. We're going to implement positive leadership, positive practices, positive culture. Here's what he said. I'm going to paraphrase what he said, but it's close to the quotation. He said, look, when I took over this, it looked like this was just positivity, smiles. I mean, soupy, syrupy stuff. What I learned, however, is that this was a major change, a culture change, a process change. There was no end, no final grade. It's the way we do business. He said, we implemented processes and practices, the objective of which was, and here's what's interesting. He said, we want to have our customers and employees consider us to be the best in the technical aspects of our business, but then by succeeding above all understanding. That was his phrase. I mean, we're so good, nobody can understand how we got this way. Well, he said, we just implemented a bunch of practices, and here's what happened. Not only was there a successful merger, they kept 95% of their customers, which was a big shock, but it became the largest business in Prudential, currently is. They improved their financial performance by a factor of 10.
Wow.
The growth rate was 20% per year in an industry where the growth rate is 3 or 4%. So times 5 or times 6 industry average, and so on. Well, one of the people that John hired to help with the merger was a guy named Jim Malazzi. Jim was then 3 or 4 years later made the president of another one of the Prudential businesses. When he took over, they were losing $70 million. The year before, they'd lost $140 million. So if you just lost $210 million in 2 years, you're in big trouble. I got a new CEO.
Sure.
Jim essentially did the same thing. He said, look, when I took over, we were in trouble. So I said, we have to focus on what we can do rather than what we can't do or don't do. We got to focus on the positive parts of who we are rather than the negative parts. And he said, when we did that, it just changed everything in this organization. And so, as it turns out, they went from $70 million in the red to $20 million in the black in 12 months. Mm-hmm. 2 times business plan. Again, industry average times 4 industry average. Warren Buffett's company bought that business, by the way, after 4 or 5 years. Stock price was double the parent company. I mean, and they won the J.D. Power Award for service and so on. In other words, just in that one place, financial services, where you'd say of all the places, positivity would not work, is a bottom line. I got to have outcome. I got to have profitability. That would be the least likely place it works. But it was a dramatic success when they took this seriously. So that's just one story of how bottom line impact is you have to worry about that. You have to be held accountable.
So as you're managing teams, and one of the things that I think a lot of times when people are doing reviews of employees, they're focused on, maybe what's gone wrong during the year. This whole positive leadership, how does that impact as far as how somebody should be conducting reviews and managing their team?
It's a good question, because all of us know bad news sells. Negative information has big impact. I mean, there really is a lot of information about that. If I'm in an interview and I say something screwy, it's going to take 7 statements that are impressive to overcome the one that's not. So bad is stronger than good. So, because that's the case, we need to focus on or emphasize, highlight the good parts, the positive parts. So there's all kinds of suggestions about how that might be done. There's a kind of a classic study done by a colleague of mine in which they simply took a group of individuals. These were all top management team people. And they were measuring outcomes in their own organizations. They brought them together, actually at my university, had them sit in a room for one day in a room surrounded by one-way mirrors. On the other side of the mirrors were doctoral students observing these people working, coding the communication that was going on in the room. Now, in advance, these people had sent data about performance, productivity, customer satisfaction, profitability, and so on. At least those 3 for sure. Oh, they also had 360 ratings by colleagues. How good a leader are you? All right. As it turns out, they put them in 3 categories. High performing, if they scored above average on those factors. Average or below average, low performing organizations on those outcomes. Those organizations that were above average on those outcomes, bottom line outcomes, had an average of 3 positive statements made. No, sorry, 5 positive statements made for every negative statement. Those that did below average had an average of 3 negative statements for every positive statement. That is just the communication going on in those organizations that were doing especially well. Were much more. This had a highlighting. We're highlighting the positive. Now, to be fair, there is a ratio between about 3 and about 8. That is about three positives to every negative. If you get above eight, it's too syrupy. You're not worrying about things you should worry about. Below three, you don't get the advantage. So one of the factors that occurred in these teams and in these organizations was they simply said, all right, look, what we have to do is simply focus on what we're doing well as opposed to what we're not, or in addition to what we're not, not as opposed to, but in addition. We got to make sure we don't just focus on problem solving. We got to focus on what's next that we can look forward to that's positive and optimistic. So communication mattered a lot in those studies. And there's a whole bunch of other studies, by the way, that confirm that sort of 3-to-1 or up to 5-to-1 positive to negative ratio. Organizations that do better simply have more positive talk. It's not soupy, it's not syrupy, it's not saccharine sweet. It's making sure we get the results, but we don't do it. I mean, it's an example I heard yesterday from a coach. He's a professional tennis player. He then became the coach of a women's team at a university. And he said, I simply try to help my players think differently instead of, oh, doggone it, I can't forget that, or I need to forget that. He said, I just changed that to, I need to remember that. I changed negative words to positive words. He has these wonderful stories about coaching Olympic athletes. And one of the things that he does is he tries to change them from, doggone it, I screwed up, I didn't do so well. No. What are you going to do that's better next time? Think about the positive. This is, you know, you're competent, you're going to do it next time or whatever. I mean, he's more eloquent in talking about that than I am. And he's trained several Olympic gold medalists, you know. Anyway, communication matters, Mark.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I've heard you talk about when somebody, as you mentioned, a coach that is trying to get people's performance up to the new level, that you mentioned that, you know, if you watched, I think there's been studies where people have watched videos of themselves doing something poorly or wrong as far as in sports versus watching what you've done right. Talk a little bit about that, the importance of.
Yeah. Sure. I'll give you just another study that was done. This study was done where simply it had to do with bowling, going down to the bowling alley and bowling. So let's assume we have a group of people, we all go down and bowl. And we bowl three games because we got to get a baseline about how good we are. Then we're going to film everyone as they bowl. Half of the people, we're going to show them when they made strikes and spares, when they knocked all the pins down. The other half of the people, we will show them only when they did not make strikes and spares, when they essentially failed, didn't do so well. We're going to do that for 1 month, and we're going to challenge people. In fact, I'll say, I will give you $100 if you can improve your bowling score by an average of 10 pins per game. But you only have 30 days to do that. Mm-hmm. We got the baseline. How good are you? 30 days later, well, we're going to, so half of the people are watching themselves make strikes. Half of the people are watching themselves fail. We're going to come back together in 1 month. We'll all go down and bowl three more games. Turns out those who are watching themselves succeed are significantly more likely to have improved by a score of by 10 pins per game than those who are watching themselves fail. All I have to do is watch myself succeed and my performance actually goes up. So, I mean, that's just one study of quite a few that highlight that notion that success will help us get better. Now, that doesn't mean that we ignore mistakes and problems and issues. It rather means that we put an and between those two alternatives as opposed to an or. That is, it's not problem-centered or positive. It's in addition to those things we have to worry about. I mean, if I got diabetes, I can do push-ups all day long. I got to worry about diabetes. But I can get so consumed and immersed in that my life is in trouble. And I never do progress.
So if you're looking at the work that you've done around positive leadership, is there a way as far as to figure out, you know, as you're hiring, putting together teams of people as far as to work together? You mentioned the impact of positive energy.
Yes.
Is there a way to figure that out as far as through assessment or through other means that you found that's a pretty good way, or
how you interview? That's a great question, Mark. And there is. there was a colleague who's a senior vice president of human resources for a company who learned about this and decided that the challenge was, how are we going to identify positive energizers? If this matters a lot, well, how do we figure out who they are? So the normal way you interview people for jobs is, you know, tell me about a major challenge you had and how'd you overcome it. Tell me about a major conflict and how'd you work through that, and so on. She flipped those questions to be, and I love those questions. I mean, I'm not going to get the wording the way she does it, but I revised them for me. The questions that she asked are things like this. Tell me about an organization that you've absolutely fallen in love with. What was it about that organization that you loved so much? Tell me about a role you performed that you said, man, I love this. What was it about the role? What is it you did that was so good? Tell me about a time that you've helped somebody else fulfill their potential, help them get a lot better. What did you do? How'd you contribute to their success? Tell me about a time when you had just enormous, surprisingly unbelievable success in your organization. What'd you do? Tell me about that experience. She said, we have a lot of people who can't answer those questions. They've never been at their best. They've never helped somebody else be at their best. They've never fallen in love with any organization. She said, we don't hire them. We only hire those that, yeah, they've experienced peak performance. They've experienced contributing. They've experienced positive energy themselves and recognize it. And, oh, I tell you what, we have, my academic department, this is going to sound very egotistical, but my academic department is normally rated as the number one management department in business schools in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, we publish more than others. We have more fellows in the academy and so on. But the major reason for that is we have three criteria we use to hire people. Number one is you got to be a world-class scholar. No surprise, everybody wants those. You got to add to the scholarly community. Number two is you got to be a good teacher, of course. Everybody wants good teachers. Number three, I think, is a differentiator. You have to be a net positive energizer. You have to add more positive energy to the system than you extract. Which means I've got 15 colleagues who have committed to help me get better every day, and I've made the same commitment to them. I mean, we have this enormously collaborative, thriving group who are just dedicated to help each other. I mean, we're all positive energizers because we are conscious that that's part of the criteria we want. So we look for those when we hire folks. Works with it.
So let me flip the other side of it. So say that you're a manager or leader and you've inherited a group that has some people that are sucking the energy out of the organization. You know, I know one solution to that, but are there some others that could potentially turn that situation around?
That's a good question. I'm going to violate my at least internal promise that I don't like to share anything that doesn't have empirical evidence. This does not. It's just based on my experience.
Sure.
So I think there are four steps when you encounter black holes, de-energizers. People are just viruses sucking the life out of everybody. Step number one is to give them feedback, direct, objective feedback. That doesn't mean you beat them up. It just simply means, look, here's what I'm noticing your behavior is, here's what it is, and here's what the impact is on our organization. When you're interrupting people, when you lose your temper, when you don't greet people when you come in the office, it has a difficult, it's a difficult setting. It creates a pall over the organization. Here's a suggested alternative for you. That is, it's supportive feedback. Now, that should be preceded normally by questions. What's going on with you? What don't I understand? How can we help you be better or flourish more in this organization? So understanding them and giving them feedback, that's number one. Most of the time, that has some kind of an impact. I mean, most people don't want to be curmudgeons or, you know, offend as many people as they can during the day. So feedback is often, if it's objective and helpful, I have your best interest at heart, and I'm going to try to help you. All right. If that doesn't work, second step, development, opportunities for alternatives. I mean, you know, you send them to a program, or you give them a counselor, or you give them a coach, or you give them some kind of a person who can assist them along. Because some people say, well, this is just the way I am.
Right.
Well, that's not helpful to you or to us. So let's give you some other alternatives and help you practice. I mean, that's what you do on a football team, for heaven's sake, or a basketball team. I can't dribble with my left hand. Well, let me help you do that, because we need a guy who can cross over. You know, if that doesn't work, and almost always it does, if you're sincere and have their interests in heart. Well, I'm going to take a side trip. This happens a lot, by the way, in organizations where people say, look, we got this very valuable person. He's in IT. He's in technology. He's in something. I mean, he's a curmudgeon. He's an engineer. We can't fire this person because he's way too valuable. But boy, he's toxic. Mm. So step number three is make them peripheral, meaning isolate the virus. I mean, put that guy in the office, let him tinker around, let him do the IT stuff, let him do whatever he does, you know, let him in the hospital, let him do a surgery, but don't let him infect, take the microphone out of his hand. Don't let him infect the whole rest of the organization if we can't get rid of him. Now, that's sometimes completely impractical, but, you know, sometimes it's not. Sometimes, all right, let him do his thing, but put him in the basement. I figure. If that doesn't work, number four is let them flourish elsewhere. Now, that doesn't mean throw them out with the garbage, and that doesn't mean alternative number one. That means I've tried a lot of things. You're not flourishing. We're not flourishing. Let's find a place where you can. Let me help you someplace else do what you want to do. It won't be here, but I'm just not going to cut you off. I'm going to say I'm still concerned about having you flourish, but it's not going to be here. Those are my prescriptions, four steps.
No, that's helpful. You've written a number of books. How many books is the total that you've written?
Well, 15 books, but I have to tell you, Mark, I write as a replacement for sleeping pills, so you have a hard time pick up my book.
Yeah. So if you were to choose, I know it's sometimes like trying to choose which child is your favorite, but if you were to choose one of your books that you think would be that you'd recommend first, I should say it that way, first to read, which one would that be?
Well, it would probably be the book that was originally motivated by having executives say, okay, I'm convinced this stuff works. I'm convinced of the empirical evidence. So how can I do it? And so the book simply called Positive Leadership, written, it's only 120 pages on purpose. It's an airplane ride book. You know, you can read it between here and New York. There's a follow-up to that that just has more specific practices, practicing positive leadership. And I just finished one. It's not out yet. It's just in the publishing process right now, on positive energy. Mm. Just focusing on that part of positive leadership. But it would be just the positive leadership book, probably.
Great. Well, outside of your books, which I encourage everybody to read, what other books have influenced you? Anything that you would say to a leader, you should read this book?
Yeah, there are wonderful books. There are wonderful books by my colleagues. Bob Quinn has written wonderful books. His first book, I think, that put his work on the map and has had big impact on lots of folks, would be called Deep Change. He's followed up from that book with several others, Building the Bridge as You Walk on It, and
right.
One that's called Lift. You know, so Bob's books are wonderful. another person who I think has done wonderful work, empirically based work in positive psychology per se, is Barbara Fredrickson's book. She had a book simply called Positivity, and her second one was called Love 2.0, has to do with relationships. The grandfather of positive psychology is Marty Seligman. And Marty's book called Flourish is probably as good a book as there is, just summarizing the psychological part of this. I have colleagues here at the University of Michigan who have done wonderful work because it's organization in focus as opposed to psychologically focused, and talking about the impact on organizations per se. And so one of them would be my friend Wayne Baker, whose latest book just came out a few months ago. It's called All You Have to Do Is Ask. The fundamental basis upon which that book is written is we could get a lot of help from a lot of people. People are willing to contribute. People are generous by nature, but we don't ask. And for a lot of reasons. And so he gives wonderful prescriptions about how organizations and individuals can get better by learning how to ask without feeling like you're being a subordinate or incompetent, you know. So those are some. I'm leaving out a lot, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's always great to hear people's recommendations because there's always, and I've read several of Bob's books, but yeah, those are a great, great books to be reading and applying. Outside of work, Kim, what do you do to recharge?
Well, last night I had a recharging event because we were online with our seven children.
Wow.
We're all over the world. Well, from near Toronto to Monterey, California. Nobody's close to us in Michigan, but we are able to connect by way of Zoom. And it, you know, it's family. It's seven children and wonderful spouses, 24 grandchildren.
Wow. Who are
ashamed. And that's what life's all about for me.
Yeah, great. Well, this if somebody would want to learn more about your work and your books, is there a good spot for them to head?
I spend very little time on Facebook or LinkedIn, as it turns out, but I'm more than happy. I'm delighted to reply to emails or contacts. So my email is simply my name, Kim, K-I-M, _ Cameron, C-A-M-E-R-O-N, @ UMICH, that's University of Michigan, UMICH.edu. And I'm delighted if people want to reach out. I'm happy to send materials or converse.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, appreciate your generosity with your time and your thoughts today, and definitely wish you continued success. And with your new book, definitely looking forward to that, and wish you the best.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.